The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
'18 is about to be in the record books. Great guests, terrific discussions during 50 plus hours of podcasting. Don't worry, plenty more to come in 2019. And today we're looking back at some of this year's highlights. All this and much more on the best of 2018 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And welcome to you. This is Andrew Horowitz, the host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. What a year. I mean, really. First of all, I got to thank you for listening, for all the time you put in, for all the time that we put in producing this wonderful series. It was a record-breaking year by many measures, not only in the markets, not only in the world, but on so many fronts. We had over 10 million downloads and counting. I just looked a little while ago, and that was the number overall. So thanks for that. I think it was pretty impressive that we're able to reach that number. We talked about so many things this year, didn't we? We talked about areas ranging from markets and psychology. We talked about history and the future. We had listener questions, portfolio positioning. That's just to name a few of the things that we talked about, because we really spent a lot of time on so many varied discussions with so many wonderful guests. And all of the just the guests that gave their time and their advice, their smarts, their intellect. I think we have some of the best guests anywhere when it comes to financial podcasts and podcasts about markets and information, because I don't know, it seems to me that nobody's really necessarily pushing their book. Nobody's going out there doing anything more, and I don't let them, but to help educate and entertain a bit and provide us with the information that we need on a regular basis to make some really smart decisions and to be better investors and set for a secure financial future overall. We don't always hit the mark just right, of course, but we are trying to really get at the heart of what it's all about, from the baseline of what it is to invest to all the way through some stock ideas and some sectors and some, you know, some areas that may be of interest. And we did that with, I think, some great people throughout the year. Well, what I thought we'd do in this show, which is dedicated to some of this year's highlights, picked up a few discussions. I look back on what we talked about throughout the year. When I thought there was something really interesting, I would clip it. And we came up with, I don't know, maybe six different discussions throughout the year that I thought were really some of the better ones we had on a variety of topics. And let's start it off with where we started the year. Right in the beginning of January, we had guest Danielle DiMartino Booth. And during our conversation in episode number 543, we looked at the idea of pricing power, GDP, and monetary policy. And it seems to me that the GDP is similar, that, you know, 2.5% or so for a developed country doesn't seem to be the worst thing in the world to me. But they're so concerned about getting back to 3% or 4% or whatever the number is that, you know, I just don't really understand where that is also a number that is being stoked around as really the important number to hit.
You know what? It's a lot of this is politicking and optics, right? People, the politicians of the world want to be able to go into the midterm elections and say, you know, we have, after 10 years of 2%, we've created 12 months of 3%. Mm. It optically, it looks a lot better. It really does. And I mean, you know, who knew that the Republicans, and again, this is not a partisan statement on my behalf. You lose one more senator, to retirement, and it's going to flip regardless.
Yeah.
If it's not replaced by a Republican. Again, this is just simple math in the Senate and in the House. But who knew that they should wake up and thank their lucky stars the day that Hurricane Harvey made landfall, and that they should be pounding the table when Irma hit, and having a flat out party when the wildfires broke out on the West Coast and Maria shellacked Puerto Rico, because that is what at the margin has created this 3% growth rate that will probably continue through the first quarter and keep the Federal Reserve on a tighter tightening path than it would be otherwise, because we had these magnificent natural disasters that created the impetus to, lumber, truckers, you name it. The rebuilding effort is unprecedented when you consider that the only thing that we have to compare it to, historically speaking, is Hurricane Katrina.
You know, it's funny I had this discussion and everybody's like, well, oh my, we have all these horrible things that are happening. I got all these emails saying, oh, terrible. You know, it's really going to be a problem for the economy and all this. And I said, think about this for a second. Yes, it is a momentary problem when everybody is worrying about, oh my gosh, this whole area is shut down. Nobody's working. So you have whatever time period that is, 2 to 3 weeks, 4 weeks till they start to get things going. But the backside of this, particularly when you have a very, fires, for example. I mean, fire is a great example. It just burns down the house. You have to rebuild from the ground up. It's not just a repair, and this actually pushes in a dramatic amount of construction building, jobs that will move down there. There'll be a gigantic transfer of money from insurance companies and FEMA to individuals. And this will create a very interesting short-term economic boom in those areas that will feed back into the rest of the economy, providing for a really nice number on GDP, either locally or spread out. And they're like, oh, I never thought of it that way. I mean, these natural disasters are actually, why do you think we had such, good boom during war times? I mean, you have to do this money coming into the system to do stuff.
Of course there is. And there are, if you think about the rebuilding effort in Europe and the Marshall Plan. But look, by the same token, what the other thing that I don't think most, and look, I am typically a glasses half empty kind of a girl, and I'm the biggest cheerleader right now I know. This is a complete Shirley MacLaine full-blown out-of-body experience I'm having. This is bizarre for me. But again, people, it's just adding up the dollars and cents. And I say cents, S-E-N-S-E. 2017 was supposed to be the year of the magnificent, great, wonderful, strong dollar. Well, it wasn't.
That was weird.
So it was weird, but the boon to manufacturers on top of all these natural disasters, again, just add it up. Our exports are more competitive on the global stage. Ergo, we sell more of them. Period. End.
Why did the dollar drop as much as it did? I mean, it seemed that we had a lot of things going for it with starting with, even before elections and all that, we had issues regarding increase of rates by the Fed and tightening. That should have done well. We had good manufacturing and a good backdrop economically. That should bring the dollar higher. You need all the ingredients into this. And then seemingly the tax code was, passed and a few other things didn't. But yet the dollar, I don't know if the dollar's telling us something, by the way, because usually you have a weakening dollar in a weakening economic backdrop. I don't know what's going on. Why are we, is it really just the European situation?
Now I'm going to play devil's.
Okay.
Devil's advocate. State 50, a bloodbath in retail, all kinds of store closures. Before Hurricane Harvey hit, on a year-over-year basis, we were in a recession in the automobile industry.
Right.
The consumer sector was starting to reflect that year-over-year recession in the automobile industry, with back-to-back-to-back increases in subprime auto delinquencies, which, by the way, has continued in the background unchecked. Month after month after month, these delinquencies continue to get worse, and credit card loss provisions have continued to build as well. We just had a great discussion about the fact that all of this rebuilding effort was going to create genuine economic output. There's no disputing that. And the fact that manufacturers have done well, I mean, the most recent Chicago Purchasing Managers Index was blockbuster. It was huge. Mm-hmm. But by that same token, there are a lot of people who are making less money or who have lost their jobs in retail, if you're not in a trade where vocational training has fallen off the map for two generations, and therefore you can charge whatever you want, because that is true pricing power when it comes to demanding what you want for wages. Because people have not been, you know, flocking by the millions to attend truck driving school. So if you're a truck driver today, you name your price. Period, end. If you're a welder, if you're in if you're a general contractor, you can name your price. If you're not in one of these industries, good luck. And that is the part of the U.S. household sector that is suffering. That is why FHA mortgages are nearing a 10% delinquency rate. Still waters run deep. That's one of my favorite sayings. And we have a very buoyant, robust, strong economy right now on the face of it. But underneath the surface, things continue to weaken for the other half of Americans who have absolutely no pricing power when it comes to what their paycheck is going to reveal.
In March, we talked about the idea of tariffs and how tariffs were totally spooking markets. And it seemed at the time that there was nothing more that was going on here than just trial balloons that were being sent up and seeing, hey, how will things, you know, how will they react? How will markets react to all this? And as soon as markets really got upset and disturbed, it seemed like they talked it down. Markets then, you know, went from reacting really poorly to back to, you know, the grind higher. And in episode 551, we discussed how this feels like, it felt like a Bubba Gump moment. I guess we got to start with the most ridiculous set of events that I've seen in a while. The process of tariffs, the shenanigans of how this was presented, what we heard about, the whole idea of it's good, it's bad. This is some of the things that we were listening to throughout the week. Tariffs, tariffs, tariffs. It was all over the news.
According to multiple sources, Trump's transition team is working with the possibility of imposing tariffs on foreign imports. This move would deliver on Trump's America First campaign theme.
What I want to ask you about is what comes next in terms of tariffs. The president mentioned aluminum and steel. That has been something that that industry has been waiting on.
The New York Times just posted a story saying that the signing for those tariffs that we've been waiting for, the actual details underlying the proposal the president announced last week, will be at noon tomorrow.
U.S. President Donald Trump said the United States will impose tariffs on steel and aluminum imports next week. For steel, it's a 25% tax. For aluminum, 10%.
Tariffs! I mean, have you ever seen so much coverage of something that changed by the minute? We saw that we had the announcement of tariffs and the pullback of tariffs. We saw that there was conversation about how other countries are going to see this, what jobs are going to be created. It was like the Bubba Gump shrimp. Remember that? Remember the Bubba Gump shrimp, the way that they were described in the movie? If you remember, you got barbecue it, boil it, broil it, bake it, saute it. Then there's shrimp kebab, shrimp creole, shrimp gumbo, pan fried shrimp, deep fried shrimp, stir fried. I mean, man, it went on and on, right? Same thing here. What do we have here? We got big tariffs, little tariffs, carve-out tariffs, negotiated tariffs, excluded tariffs. We had hard tariffs and then soft tariffs, retaliatory tariffs, tariff sell-offs, tariff rallies, tariff benefits, tariff losses. I mean, total tariff overload. And if you follow this whole ridiculous process, well, aside from the fact that it was pretty sloppy, let's kind of do a quick summation and chronological discussion of what happened. So first we get a big announcement through Twitter that, well, we're going to put a 25% tariff on steel and 10% on aluminum. That's it. That's all we knew. Markets freaked out, right? The steel stocks went higher. They rallied. Aluminum-related companies that produced and manufactured did well. There was discussion of higher prices, all sorts of benefits, right? We're going to get jobs. All this great stuff is going to happen here. Then all of a sudden we saw a lot of discussion, comments, and murmurs about retaliation. And inflation concerns, because now all of a sudden there's going to be higher prices. Trade war enters the conversation, another tweet by our president. Now moving along till April in 2018, we had Daniel Crosby on, a psychologist, a market expert when it comes to the idea of market psychology. And during our conversation, he helped us better understand the idea of groupthink and communal fictions. So we had markets moving wildly over the past few months during that time, and it led up to this discussion. And we learned how penguins can offer some important insights during episode number 557. So now going with the crowd, this is a great part of the discussion I think that we should have here. You know, this whole idea that, there's this crowd or groupthink. Penguins. Penguins are a great example, right? If you ever watched a video of penguins that are standing on the edge of an iceberg about to jump off. Everybody waits. They all wait. One guy goes, that's it. They're all in. Right? Right. I mean, that's the whole groupthink concept. So you see recently so many analysts and guests on TV and writings, radio, podcasts. I'm talking about the sell side primarily. I'm not talking about us podcasters, which we'll get into your new show in a second, but they're all saying the same thing. It seems as there's no outliers. And I wonder, from a psychological standpoint, from a groupthink standpoint, is this something to be feeling confident about or concerned?
Yeah, so you spoke earlier about the news, like how there's so much bad news, and yet markets tend to continue to climb this wall of worry. So I'll share a story that I share in the new book, The Behavioral Investor. I was on a prominent 24/7 financial news network recently, and before I went on to said news network, I have the producer in my ear. Right, you're wearing an earpiece, yep. And you can hear them talking. And as I'm going on, they're kind of counting down. Okay, Dr. Crosby, you're on in 5, 4, 3, 2. And right before they give me the final 2-1, they said, give us something juicy. Don't be a nerd.
Right? Oh, there you go.
And so this to me is like such a great sort of inside baseball, behind the scenes look at how the sausage gets made. You know, you get someone like me who's an academic who has, a vested interest in being nuanced and scientific. And they're saying, don't be a geek, man. Like, give us something good. They didn't say be truthful and nuanced and scientific. They said, don't be a nerd. And so remember that story the next time you're hearing some catastrophic doom and gloom news story, that's how the sausage gets made. Yep. So in terms of the herd mentality, it's fascinating to me because I talk about in the book, I talk about research that was done by the guy that wrote Sapiens. If you have not read that book, I can't recommend it enough to your listeners. But the book Sapiens is all about sort of human development, the development of Homo sapiens over the last 200 something thousand years. And he talks in there about how we are wired to believe in communal fictions. So we believe in things like, the Constitution or the state of Alabama or the Catholic Church or whatever you want to say. All of these things are man-made institutions, and our belief in these communal fictions is what allows us to build great societies. It's absolutely the best thing that we have going. And money, he says, is the greatest of these communal fictions of all. Like, money's something we all believe in, we all work for, but it's only as good as our belief in it, right? So from a very, very fundamental level, we are wired to reason, not in terms of whether or not something is true, but whether or not it's socially acceptable. And while that belief in shared fictions allows us to build great civilizations and religions and states, right? Mm-hmm. It also can be our downfall in markets because we are absolutely wired to believe what other people believe. So, this group narrative that emerges in the news is partially born out of human nature and partially born out of a desire for clicks and eyeballs.
Who writes a lot about this is, Ben Hunt, Epsilon Theory.
Oh, yes, I do.
He writes a lot about this. He recently wrote about something called the nudging state. And he talks about how the idea is that, well, you really need to be aware of the fact that there is an eye in the sky, if you will. There's some concerted effort by them, whoever they are, them, okay, that are trying to sway people's behavior by slow and steady nudges to do a specific action. So, for example, he used the Fed. So the Fed says, well, economics are good
and times are good. And we're going to do this way and slowly. And they kind of adjust their numbers and their conversation to push people to do a certain thing, which is kind of like one more step beyond the groupthink that I want to do that. But it's okay. I want to at least play the game. You know, don't fight the Fed. I want to stay with the idea that, okay, this must be what everybody's doing. This must be what is right to do. Therefore, I believe it's right also. Now, here we are in July when I had some words with Frank Curzio. We banged heads a bit on the benefits and the detractions of tariffs. And we also had an interesting discussion about Tesla. This is all in episode number 571. So what about, I mentioned on a quick email that I sent you, let's talk about Tesla. And you replied, by the way, just full disclosure, you write, we can skip Tesla. My thesis is the same as everyone else on this. That's what you wrote back to me.
I wrote because, I've done the numbers on Tesla and I just.
There are no numbers.
It's funny that he's like, I mean, we're not going to have to raise money. And when you look at the numbers in the billions, listen, they might not have to raise money this year, but they're going to have to raise money like January 2nd. and the fact that he's really focused, I think it's more of a red flag that he's really focusing on the media now and getting pissed off at things. Sorry if I can say it, but he's getting really ticked off at things like that. Going after the media and stuff like that. I just think he's
not only media, he's going after individuals.
Yeah, and everyone. But the thing is, what worries me with this stock is there's, and what I meant by that, which is funny now that you read it, is I'm not going to say anything that's not has.
You're not going to add to the argument, is your point.
And here's the thing: there's nothing that I could say that's already been added to this, which makes me think. Based on my experience, because I've been wrong a few times, not a lot, because otherwise I'd have to find another job. But when you have the same thesis as everybody else, it kind of makes you think that that should be priced into the stock right now.
So what are you saying? It's going to go up from here?
I'm saying there's a good shot that you can see a massive short squeeze because the whole entire world is short on this stock. And the fact that they're all short for the same exact reason. I mean, look at Herbalife.
How weird was that?
He tried to prove that was a Ponzi scheme. But after 3 years and you can't do it, it's not a Ponzi scheme.
It was proven to be some wrongfully created, their business practices were found to be a problem. They were fined $230 million, $240 million, something like that. And they were told that they have to change their business practices. Meanwhile, you would think with that was a very big, hey, Ackman, you were right about this. And if they do change their business model to be less of a multi-level marketing concept and all that, then what's going to happen is they're no longer going to be able to make the money that they made before. Therefore, okay, you are right. Meanwhile, the stock goes straight upwards.
I disagree just because I don't think he was right, because what he was saying is that the company's absolute fraud should be worth zero. What they did is they have a business model that millions of companies have. Could it be described as a Ponzi scheme? Depends how you define it, because if you go online and Facebook, and there's a lot of people who have, you know, younger kids and children, my wife has friends where they're selling all these beauty products and they have to bring on more people and more people and they get paid more money. So is it a legal business? Well, you know, no, it's not. But he was basically saying this is an illegal business. This is fraud. This is going to go to zero. And for me, I didn't think, I think you can go to any business. Look at Comcast. I mean, Comcast charges me more every single, like, I have no idea. I'll talk to five different people.
It's not like, hey, Frank, ring, ring. Hey, Frank, how you doing? Oh, yeah, good. Oh, hey, I was thinking about having a little Comcast party. Invite your friends. I got this great product I want to show you. You know what I mean?
That's what you did, though. You called me about your whole trading system. You said you're going to have friends over and want to talk about
it. Oh, yeah, we have a trading system party. Yeah, we have an investment advisor party. I guess they call them seminars in our business.
Now, you have a point. For me, when he's going out and trying to hire, lobbying to the government so they can investigate this firm, my point of the whole thing is not really Herbalife, but when – for me, my mistakes have been made when I'm on the same side as everybody else. It's usually priced into the stock. So it's going to be interesting where are they going to raise capital? They have to raise capital based on the numbers. I've done a lot of research, but they have to raise it.
Of course.
I've covered this on my Curzio Research Facebook page. I do live videos and stuff. But you could see any positive news or anything. I mean, the amount of shorts on this thing could push this thing up 30% like in a couple months. And we saw that happen before coming back down. Just be careful if you're going to short this thing, because that's usually for the professionals, not for individual investors.
Now, just a month later, we had this discussion about, I think it was a pretty fascinating discussion about robotics and the potential for what will be in the future with regards to automation. And our guest was author and his name is John Pugliano. Episode number 578.
All this talent, and then he's enabled with technology. That's you know where I think it's going to go.
What's really fascinating is with all of this technology, all of this talk of robotics, all which by the way, a lot have been implemented. This is not like a revolutionary 10 years from now concept. We've seen a lot of automation already be implemented in many places, right? From small automation to large-scale automation, to small-scale robotics to large-scale robotics, displacing the worker who has a mechanical style to their job that is repeatable, that can be replaced. However, we're still at a 3.9% unemployment rate. And if you don't like the fact that the labor participation rate is what it is and all that, and we still factor all this, the truth of the matter is we're still adding to the payrolls each and every month. Is there a concern, of yours that something is going to break if we go into a downtrend? And let me just add one more thing here. There's something that we coined called consumption cannibalism. And what happens is that the more automated we get, the more displaced workers are, the more potential we have for people to actually buy less, which, by the way, is more deflationary due to the fact that if you have, as I mentioned before, any kind of machinery or item that can replace somebody, totally replace somebody, and they're no longer buying shirts, they're no longer buying food, you know, the robots. And then you have the secondary issue that those other people that are displaced are going to have to find another job, possibly. But in a downturn, they won't. So the potential is we're going to see a magnification of this consumption cannibalism, where now we're no longer consuming because we're building with something else, and therefore we don't need the items anymore. Everything starts to like domino effect and implode on itself. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I think we are headed that way. Again, I don't know. I'm not predicting gloom and doom. I don't know how long it's going to take for these kind of things to take effect. But look at it this way. First of all, why are corporate profits so high? Well, there's a lot of reasons. But one, I do think, as you go back to the recession in 2008, they reduced a lot of headcount and they never replaced that headcount, right? It's gone. Even if you look at and you say, well, unemployment numbers are low, it's not equivalent to what they would have been paying had they stayed on the normal growth rate. So they're already not employing as many people as they did. Also, because of technology, look at the major corporations where we do have the concentrated wealth. A company like Google or Facebook, which employ, I don't know, their employees are in the low 10,000s, maybe something like that.
Well, I mean, Facebook just put on 50, or it's putting on 50, but yeah, okay.
But compare that comparatively to what General Motors or somebody like that, U.S. Steel, 50 years ago would have had to have, you know, to create the same dollar value.
Right.
That's where the productivity has kicked in, but it's helped just a smaller percentage of the overall population. The other thing is, and with this being a long-term trend, those kind of manly jobs, the jobs where it was more, you needed more muscle than you needed brain power, those jobs in the United States hit their peak in, I believe it was 1957, like late 1950s. You know, that's when the big
the big manufacturing post-World War
big
boom.
Manufacturing, yeah. and that's when male unemployment rates started to decrease. Okay, and then you take that forward to just general manufacturing jobs. Manufacturing jobs in the U.S. peaked in, I believe, 1979. Okay, so no matter how much Trump is going to try and make America great again and bring back manufacturing jobs, there's no doubt in my mind manufacturing jobs are coming back. They're just going to be done in dark black factories with many less humans in them than would have otherwise been needed. So, I mean, I think that's where all the hazard is for employment. At the same time, though, Andrew, we get back to what we started this discussion with. It's deflationary in nature. So while there's less people working or there's maybe less opportunity for people to work, it potentially could cost less to live. Living expenses could be lower.
I think you're correct with that. And I think also the other thing to note here in this whole discussion is something you wrote on page 65 of your book. You wrote, a robot is a tool. You said, when all knowledge is correlated into expert decision support systems, what need will be there for the human expertise? It's a question. Humans will only become irrelevant when they cease to be human. Journeyman machinists are no longer needed to mass produce precision parts. However, humans are still employed as to design and create new products. A robot is a tool used to efficiently manufacture an item. A human is needed to conceive of the item. I think that's really important, Oles, and this is getting back to your point of what are humans going to be doing? Well, humans create the robots. Humans are the ones that create things. The robots are the ones that maybe do the output. So the jobs that are going to be the most important to have are those in the creative department, not just creative like websites. I mean, creation and innovation, right?
Absolutely. And really, that's why I wrote the book. It's not, again, it's not a gloom and doom book to say, hey, we're all going to, you know, we're all going to be unemployed. It's to help people understand that their real value in the future, just like it's really been in the past, it's always been about your creativity. It's about your ability to create products and services to serve the marketplace. And that's going to be magnified by people that can be able to do it, because individuals are going to be able to, gets back to the nullification thing. We may not need so many government services or requirements as we did in the future, because technology will help us go around that. It'll also help us go around some larger corporations. Mm-hmm. You know, in the old days, if you wanted to, Andrew, your podcast has been around for what, 11 years?
Yep.
You know, in the old days, even prior to that, you were early into that, early into podcasting. But prior to that, you'd have had to been on some AM radio station, mm-hmm. and maybe got a Sunday night slot. And, mm-hmm. and you know, if you did a good job, you'd have maybe got syndicated into a bigger city. And then maybe you'd have got a better spot during the week or a weekly show or, you know, whatever. There were all these gatekeepers. You couldn't have uh-huh. been your own broadcaster. Mm-hmm. Today, you're your own broadcaster.
Right.
And so you're able to, because of your creativity and because of, you know, the products and services you create, you're able to use technology to circumvent those old corporate gatekeepers that would have kept you out of doing what you do today. Yeah, and we're going to see that across the board in everything, right? From blue collar jobs to white collar professionals. Again, the message of my book, the real message of my book though, is that I don't think it's the hamburger flipping jobs going away we have to worry about. I think it's the doctors and the lawyers, and in particular, like the middle managers. And a lot of those are women, right? We talked about in the 1970s, a lot of mill workers lost their jobs. They were 50-year-old men. I think you're going to see a lot of 50-year-old women losing their job now or in the future, because that middleman job is going away.
Well, it's interesting because you also, but just tack onto this idea of what's going to be, what is going to be needed. Page 100, you talk about creating value. The robots are continuing to come for your job if it's a routine or if it can't be reduced to an algorithm, or if it can be reduced to an algorithm, sorry. Automation will replace the simple and the complex. No profession will be spared redundancy. Automation will not replace the unknown because it cannot. The unknown is not routine. The unknown cannot be formulated into an equation because the unknown outcome is, well, unknown. So the point here is that, you know, there's this idea of okay, well, we know what possibly could be converted to a mechanical, automated type of job. We know that maybe possibly some things that could be tweaked a little bit, but there's the unknown of the unknown that really holds the bright spot. And then you talk about some of these things, by the way, in here, in the end of the book, you talk about, well, for example, here's some ideas. What about, and this was written back in 2017, so you're a little bit ahead and you didn't know what was going to go on, but you talked about the driverless car. You talked about a company called Mobileye, which was taken out, did very well and taken out a nice premium. You talked about NVIDIA. You really focused on NVIDIA because of their chips that were related to automation and really probably didn't have as much into that discussion as the power they used to mine Bitcoins and all that. But still, the fact is in investments, to now slide this over to the investment environment, to talk about, well, what companies or what things can actually benefit us as investors? Now, we have this whole prelude that we just discussed about all these things that were going to happen. Now, the question is, how do we capitalize on it?
Yeah. Hey, and before we do, let me just divert real quickly here to the whole job thing, because I know a lot of people are going to be listening and saying, hey, I am 50 years old or I'm 30 years old and I want to know which direction to head in. And again, I'm saying whether you're blue collar or white collar, there's going to be opportunities as well as opposition here. But think of it this way, on that repetitive, you know, easy to put in an algorithm type thing. If you're working in a factory somewhere, that's going to be automated. At the same time, if you're a doctor, just a family physician, and all you do is test for, you know, strep throat or something like that, again, that's easily automated. Not as easy as painting cars in an automobile line, But we're going to get to the point where, you know, you can blow into your smartphone and it'll tell you whether you have strep throat or not.
Coming towards the end of the year, we spent some time on an important topic. Now, in episode number 584, we took a look at the idea of active versus passive investing. This whole debate on what is the best way to go and how should investors be investing their money. Basically, we looked at this and thought that, you know what? There's a lot of advisors out there that are being just really lazy. Being lazy when they just simply recommend an ETF, don't look at the benefits of some active management, a la mutual funds, and in particular went over some of the statistics and relevance and information that we found in a very deep research piece we did on the subject. So there's an interesting situation brewing. This I found really very telling. Something that has been like a little thorn in my side for some time. Something that I've wondered, how is this going to play out? This doesn't seem like this is going to work out well in the end, okay? And it has to do with passive management. Passive management, primarily using index ETFs, we know has become really popular. I mean, really, really popular. One of the things that we're seeing as a follow-up to this is that popularity has brought an assault on fees. And ETFs have been cutting their fees left and right. We've seen this. Fidelity, zero fee. Schwab, zero fee. You know, BlackRock follows along. Any of these major ETF companies that are providing fees are trying to bring it down to zero, it seems. And all the talk and focus on fees has been doing a real number on many of the publicly traded companies. We don't know about the private ones. Have you seen the share price of BlackRock lately? Ugh, not pretty. Came out with the earnings last week, major letdown in terms of the expectations. Schwab stock dropping. It's no coincidence. You would think for a moment that a company like Schwab should be doing pretty well with their trading revenues brought up due to, you know, some of the volatility recently and have a really positive outlook. But what's happening to the stock? Well, one of the problems is, and BlackRock being the poster child for this, they're dropping their fees. They have absolutely taken the discussion the wrong direction, in my opinion. BlackRock stock was a high of $600 during this year. It's now resting on a price of $400. Essentially, if you think about it for a second, what's going on? They're a casualty of their own success. Their price is now back to levels that we didn't see since 2017. Here's the problem with the industry, as I see it. They made it all about fees. And the lower the fee, the better the deal is. Now, there is some, I think there is some logic in that to an extent. I think that when it comes to trying to emulate an index, and if that is something that I want to invest in, I should try as an investor or an advisor in my capacity to find the lowest cost alternative if that's my goal. Why not? If I'm investing in the S&P 500 and I want to utilize an ETF, all things being equal, there's the same makeup of that particular index in five different ETFs, let's say. Why not try to find the one that has two things that are important. One, the lowest fees, and two, the greatest amount of liquidity. As some of these have substantial liquidity, like the iShares or, you know, the various ETFs that everybody knows about, like SPY or IWM or QQQ, there's plenty of liquidity there. So if I am looking to find a fund in that area and utilize that in my portfolio, I'm not talking about trading here. I'm talking about holding. Why not try to find the one with the lowest cost? And advisors press that into the minds of these firms and push them, because advisors' money was going into the lowest cost one overall. Therefore, these firms felt like they had to cut costs. And in doing so, they're basically hurting themselves. The problem is, even though many bought into this whole idea, they bought into it hook, line, and sinker. Advisors are walking around like idiots. We see this as the lowest cost. Come on, guys. Is that what investors really need? In some cases, yes. I'm with you. But you know what? You're lazy. The advisor that uses ETFs only, unless there's a specific reason to do so, unless you're just emulating an equity portfolio of somehow using sectors that are specific to this a certain strategy. But if you're using a broad-based strategy that moves across all sorts of levels in terms of regions, styles, asset classes, sector classes, go down the list, right? You're being unbelievably lazy. You don't want to do the homework. You don't want to find if, in fact, there is a better alternative than just a simple ETF because it's easy. Now, of course, I also recognize that ETFs trade throughout the day and a mutual fund trades only at 4 p.m. I get that. But aside from that, if, in fact, you're preaching, and they do, hey, we're a long-term hold shop and blah, 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 blah. Well, why not do some research out of the thousands of funds that are possibly out there that maybe there's some active management that has done better for that specific sector? You can't tell me, and I know for a fact, that ETFs are not the best for every single sector. As a matter of fact, when we look at the longer-term strategy-driven processes of investing that rely on the lowest cost, it's not smart. I'm going to say that blanketly. It never has been. It never will be. So here's how we do it. I mean, it's simple. We look at this objectively, not trying to appease any particular investor by saying, oh, it's the lowest cost. No, sometimes there's a little higher cost because we want to either have better returns, lower risk. There's a lot of things that go into play here. Through the investology and the global allocations that we have, this is how we look at this. We do the legwork. We're not lazy. It takes more time. It'd be a lot easier just to throw it all into ETFs and be done with it. And in some strategies, there is some benefit there. I'll give you that. But when we look at truly globally diversified portfolios for fixed income and equities, I don't know. So what do we do? I thought we'd take a look at this, particularly in the fixed income area first, because we know that equities, generally speaking, for large cap and for highly efficient markets, ETFs, low-cost ETFs, are a good solution, probably the best solution. But what we did was we took apart the fixed income space because a lot of players are using fixed income ETFs and indices as well. And these advisors, I think, are doing a tremendous disservice, in my opinion, to their clients within that particular universe, within the area of fixed income. Not looking at what other alternatives are out there, because there are. Not saying that you have to use the alternative, but have you done the research, guys and gals? Have you really stepped up to the plate to put your client first, not only from a fee, which is what has been, for some reason, just rammed into your minds, and now all the younger advisors think that's the only way to play. And that is really a bad, bad way to go, in our opinion. Look at all the options. Don't just close your eyes off to one sector. Because if you do, there's no need for your service. Thank you very much. Have a nice day. Pack it up and just leave. You're supposed to be advising and giving the best advice when it comes to this. And if you're setting up globally allocated strategies within a portfolio, you should be using all options available. Doesn't that just make sense? Use all options available. And to end the year with what I thought was one of the best episodes ever was a discussion about American exceptionalism. We had Arthur Herman on, episode number 590, and we discussed his in-depth research on the impact of American businesses on World War II and how It was all about the businesses that came together to really create this arsenal of democracy and this incredible, just an incredible effort overall. So, you know, in the book, it seemed to me, if you were to play this out as it was the key actors in this whole drama that unfolded, it would be Knudsen, of course, would be the one that was, and Kaiser. And there was that competition constantly.
Henry Kaiser. Right.
But the names in the book that just kept, I mean, every time you would talk about some of the people, the Fords and all the people in Detroit, DuPonts, and it was, I was just taken aback by just every name in the industry, industrialized world, and they all got involved.
They all did. And Stephen Bechtel of Bechtel Corporation, Henry Kaiser, you mentioned him. Of course, his name lives on with the Kaiser Foundation and Kaiser Permanente, but it's important to realize that Henry Kaiser's real expertise was in road construction, in large-scale construction of infrastructure projects like dams. And it was really on his own hook that he realized America is going to need all of this expertise that I've assembled in the world of infrastructure construction to build military hardware, from ships, the famous Liberty ships, to steel, to aircraft. You had this enormous unleashing, not just of industrial productivity. Everybody recognized that and have talked about it, but also to enormous unleashing of American ingenuity and innovation, and of companies that did things like, I talk about one company based in Richmond, Virginia, for example, that made the wooden shells for radio sets. You know, the hardware that goes with radio sets. And so they shifted over and began manufacturing ammunition boxes for the U.S. Army. And all this was done not because the government said you've got to do this. These were people volunteering and saying we can retrain our personnel, we can reorganize our assembly line, and turn out the kind of products that you need in order to win this war. And from one part of the United States to the other, what you see is one executive or a handful, in some cases, engineers at a company who make this pledge and who make this change. I mean, I got to tell you, writing this book, it was really hard to stop, because the number of amazing stories that came and of companies, even well-known companies today, who you come to realize had made this enormous, even indispensable contribution to winning World War II. I felt it was important to document that and to really give credit to the people and to the companies and to the technologies that they unleashed.
Yeah, but the competition part of it, which is really, I thought, was really mind-blowing in terms of not competition for the sake of I'm the best, but competition to beat and be the best. In so much as, you know, you'd have the requirement to build, let's just say, 50 planes this month, and then 75 and 100, and they would come up with ways. See, if the government was just doing this, they would just go along the plan of what was required.
That's right.
And probably fall short, right? But then they would come up
That's
with
exactly
new and
right.
ingenious ways. Like you said, the Liberty ships, how they turned a mud flap into this incredible, almost an open-air production facility to build these things, right? I mean, just amazing.
Running 24/7.
Right.
And running around in Richmond, California. And then a similar set of yards in Portland, Oregon. And then Kaiser getting the heads of the two shipyards, including his son, competing with each other at who could build a Liberty ship the fastest.
Just amazing.
Or another one of my favorite stories, too, is what happened when General Electric was approached by the U.S. Army, and they said, we need to have a weapon that we can use to shoot at tanks, an anti-tank weapon that'll penetrate armor. And the GE engineer said, okay, what have you got in mind? And so he gave him basically a sketch, you know, on a piece of paper saying, do you think this would work? And the GE engineer sort of said, well, let's set out and find out. And in a matter of weeks, they managed to move over teams and assembly line from the GE plants in order to create this thing that no one had ever created before, and to develop and test and then to field them. He called it the bazooka. Came out of this, you know, of asking GE. Now, they had never made bazookas. They had never really made military hardware. They made, lights and electrical facilities and components for military trucks. But the fact was, there was a pride in being GE engineers. We can solve any problem you put in front of us. And that sense of pride, even doing things that no one had done before, is what really, I think, you see the World War II mobilization tapped into. And that's something which I think, when we think about American ingenuity, talk about American innovation, it's one of the things that I think we sorely need today when we think about where our defense industrial base is today and where it's going to be in the future.
I want to get to that. But as I was reading the book, the whole time, because you not only in the book talked about these stories, but had incredible detail about discussions that went on. And like you mentioned, somebody just drew something on a napkin. That's not necessarily a story that's chronicled somewhere, right? That's just readily available. How did you get all this information?
Well, a lot of it was published during the war and after the war, too, because so many of these companies and associations, like the Automobile Manufacturers Association, were deeply proud of what they had accomplished. You know, and so that pride made them advertise and talk to the American public during the war, and then to and then their accomplishments afterwards. They made no bounds about what it had involved. And when you read the stories, or when you go into the documentation in the archives and so on, what you see is more often than not that the government representative or the person who's come from the U.S. Navy or from the Army, because there was no Pentagon then, it was the War Department and the Department of Navy that oversaw all this activity, that by and large, they are very much the fifth wheel in all this. Their contribution more often than not proves to be an obstacle to getting things done faster and getting things accomplished. That it is the drive and the push and the dynamic of America's mobilization in World War II really was, in many ways, a bottoms-up and mid-level push. Of course, encouraged by the executives at the top, but you had your whole workforce behind this and pushing hard in this direction because they knew this was a war that had to be won, and it was sons and brothers and sweethearts whose lives depended on having the equipment they would need in order to accomplish the missions that they were set out to do.
So there's a taste of all the things that I thought were some of the highlights. Again, we had so many more guests on throughout the year, so many more topics, so many more items of interest that we discussed, some educational, some directly at what's going on in terms of the economy, some predictions, some advice, you know, general in nature, but yet at the same time, looking at the economy and seeing what we saw, what was going to be. Some, again, were right on. Some a little bit off. Some a little bit early. Maybe some a little bit late. But nonetheless, you know, the whole idea here is to really take all that we gather from our guests, from the discussions throughout the year, from the information that we see, put it all together, package together, and try to come up with the best that we can for ourselves and for our portfolios, for our investments, for our families, for our future. And, you know, put it all together, just another piece of information, another piece of the puzzle to get you where you need to be. So there's so much more coming for 2019. I want to wish you a happy, a healthy, a prosperous new year. And of course, do me a favor, tell your friends, tell your family, tell everybody on Twitter, on Facebook, on LinkedIn, wherever it is, all about the Disciplined Investor Podcast and why you listen, why you continue to listen, and why they should listen. I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for being there for me, for all your great emails, for all your great commentary, for your support, for your listening. It's really important to me, and it means a lot to me. And I really do want to thank you and thank you and thank you. It's just wonderful. It's a great relationship we have here and something that I find very special. So here's to a wonderful, hopefully 2018. That's passing. It's gone. It's moving along just about into 2019 now. Looking for some great, great guest commentary, discussions, learning experiences ahead. Thanks for joining me. And I'll see you on the other side.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.